Hey, Nikonians. It's March 6th, 2008, and we are the Image Doctors, and this is episode number 61. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
Thank you again for joining us this week at the Nikonians podcast. As always, we come to you every other week at blog.nikonians.org. What do we got on tap for this week, Rick?
Well, we've got several topics. We're going to start off with some listener mail. We haven't done that explicitly in a while, although a lot of our topics have come out of emails that we've received. And this one is actually going to be on film.
Hey, hey.
Cool. Which is something that we like talking about. So appreciate questions on that topic.
Something that we're old enough to remember using.
Yeah, way back when.
5 years ago.
Not too long ago. I still use it. But
right.
Yeah. And then we're going to talk a little bit about a location shoot that we did here recently. And that will get us a little bit into the topic of architectural photography, which I don't think we've done a lot of discussions on. And it's a fun thing. And then we're going to talk a little bit about something that people have been pestering us on for a long time, which is doing a comparison of the brand new, or at least reasonably new, 24-70 2.8 versus the older 28-70 2.8 lens. So talk a little bit about that. We'll try not to be too much into the pixel peeping realm.
But, and then we'll have our prescription. And, we'll talk about the AF fine tuning, which is that new feature you can get if you have a D300 or a D3.
Yeah, and I'm sure it'll show up in other new Nikons over time. And so we'll talk a little bit about our experiences with it. And it's been kind of enlightening, just for me.
So let's start with listener mail. We got an email from Ben Wagner from Lansdale, PA. That's Pennsylvania.
I believe so.
That's right. In the USA. And he gave us a lot of comments and a lot of feedback, especially took our advice about he found himself a used F100 recently. So he's still a film shooter. But his question essentially was, a couple questions. One, he wanted to know if we've tried the new version of Velvia 50, which was re-released after Velvia 50 got discontinued a couple of years ago, and replaced with a 100 speed version. And then he wants to know if he should be worried about how long the film is spending in his camera before he develops it. And he's heard about these color shifts that can happen to film over time, but wants a little bit of clarification on that. And how should he store his film? How long does it have before it? Is something going to go bad with his film if he keeps it in his camera for more than, you know, a month or something like that? And so that's really the question. So it's a diverse topic, but we thank you as always for the feedback, man. And I think Rick has some of the answers for you.
Sure. Let's talk about it. First, I have used the new Velvia 50. I think I'd mentioned, you know, a while ago that I was getting a little bit of it and was kind of eager to try it. And, you know, the older Velvia, you know, the original stuff, I thought was just absolutely wonderful stuff for certain kinds of shooting, especially landscape stuff. And I know I'm not the only person that felt that. And then Fuji discontinued it, came out with, you know, the faster speed Velvia, and not necessarily quite in that order. But they've gone through a couple versions of Velvia 100. There was the Velvia 100F, came out first, and a lot of people weren't too thrilled about that one. It just didn't have the same characteristics, same kind of punch, same kind of warmth, and I would agree with them. Then they later came out with the Velvia 100, which was an improvement, but still not the same stuff, in my opinion. It just didn't have the same kind of characteristics, the same kind of warmth. And there were just some neat things that the original Velvia did, especially with some of the magenta tones and things that I thought were pretty cool. So when I heard that they were coming out with a new version of the Velvia 50, I was pretty excited. And I have tried it, and at least in my casual shooting, and I'm not, you know, I haven't done any comparisons and stuff and won't because I ran out of the old stuff. It seems to me that it's a pretty close match for the original, and
oh,
I
that's
like
good
it.
To know.
Yeah. So if you enjoyed the original Velvia and you've still got, you know, some film cameras to go out there and use, I would give it a try. I think you'll enjoy it and have fun with it.
And this is ISO 50. So pretty slow.
Pretty slow.
Compared to what we're so used to now.
Right. But, you know, for a lot of shooting, it's fine.
Oh, it's great for, yeah. And that's, I think, one reason why landscape shooters liked it so much was because you're using a tripod. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Slow shutter
speed. A lot of stuff, it didn't matter too much.
Now, what about how long the film spends inside your camera.
Yeah, and the concern that he had, you know, Velvia is classified as a professional film, and so the thing that he was worried about, you know, it's typically refrigerated at the store, all that kind of stuff. You know, he was saying that sometimes it takes him a couple weeks to finish a role, you know, sometimes only a few hours, but, you know, sometimes a few weeks and is that a problem? And it absolutely is not. In fact, you can go much longer than that. Just to clarify, with the professional films, the way that they're made and released, they're put out at the peak of their color performance. Whereas with amateur films, they're released before that point. And they've got an expiration date that allows them, you know, just sitting out there in normal kinds of temperatures and stuff, to go through a certain amount of color shifts, reach the peak, and then come off the peak to some reasonable point where the results are still pretty decent.
And you got to assume that amateur film is going to be stored on the shelf for a long time at the store before you even buy it.
Right. Not refrigerated, not frozen, none of those things. So, you know, that period usually, you know, lasts for a couple years. And pro film is no more sensitive to color shifts than amateur film. They're pretty much the same thing. It's just, again, it's released at the peak. So then it's going to come down off that peak, and it's going to take some amount of time. Now, if you refrigerate it or if you freeze it, especially, you know, it's going to stay pretty much at that peak. And so when you actually start using it, that's when you'll see the slow degradation. But again, it's a slow degradation. So you certainly don't need to worry about it sitting around in your camera, you know, for a few weeks. I would say for a few months, that's fine too. No big deal. The only thing is, like with any of the films, you don't want to keep it in a really, really hot place. I mean, that's going to be bad for your camera too if it's loaded in your camera. So you want to avoid that because that will increase the degradation. You know, it'll reduce the time it takes to see a visible color shift, but don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
So thanks again to Ben Wagner for sending in his topic requests and questions. And as always, if you have a question of your own, you'd like us to read it on the air and answer your question, send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org, and we'll be happy to respond.
Yep. All right.
So let's move on to what we did over the weekend, because we had an unseasonably warm day in Colorado Springs. So we thought, hey, let's get out there, because it's March right now. This time of year, it's still, it's snowing right now as we're recording this. When we went out earlier in the weekend, we had a 60 degree day.
Yeah.
So we thought it'd be great to go outside. And one of our landmarks here in Colorado Springs is the United States Air Force Academy. And in particular, their signature building is the chapel.
Right.
It's a unique design, lots of pointy, it's triangular in shape. It's really neat to look at.
Right.
And so we thought we would go and see about shooting that at sunrise.
Right. Now, specifically, you know, one of the reasons that we were doing this too was, and this is just kind of a general thing. Periodically, we'll get questions from people, you know, that are wanting to move out of a purely amateur status and make at least a little bit of money on the side to offset equipment costs or just have fun. And, you know, stock photography is not the way to do it anymore. It's just not, you know, unless you're extremely well known. It's a bad business to be in. It's saturated. There are so many people out there producing good work with digital cameras, which makes the whole thing very easy, that there's a lot of stuff out there. So, you know, one avenue is doing things locally, shooting things that are of local interest, and then either, you know, selling them to, you know, places like restaurants, coffee houses, whatever, or, you know, putting them up for sale in craft fairs or, you know, things like that. Some restaurants will allow you to put your stuff up there or even encourage it, because that way they get some free artwork. And the stuff that always works the best is stuff that's got kind of a local flavor. So for us in Colorado Springs, Garden of the Gods, which we've talked about before, you know, famous landscape location, always sells well. And the Air Force Academy, another, you know, famous landmark, like you were saying, sells well. So we were up there doing a little bit of stock photography equivalent kinds of things with some things in mind. So that's why we were up there.
Yeah, and Well, the first thing that we learned was you have to figure out where you're going first.
Yeah.
So, because it had been a while since we've been on the grounds of the academy, and the security is a lot different now than it was a few years ago,
right?
For obvious reasons, and so there are places that you can and cannot get to that you used to be able to go to. So once we figured out where we had parked and got over to the chapel, the other thing we noticed is that the wind kicked up to about gale four. So we had about 30 or 40 mile an hour winds.
Yeah, some things you can't control.
And so we decided that we would just have a little bit of fun right around the chapel. And one thing where we were is that we were very close to it. There's a very limited area that you can be around it.
Right.
And to be on the side, it's actually on an overlook.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of a concrete wall, and then it goes down about 30 feet and there's a drop. So you can't take any farther step back.
Yeah.
And so one thing we were trying was the new 14 to 24 millimeter lens,
right,
on the D3.
Right.
And that was actually pretty much wide enough to get everything.
More than wide
there.
Enough. Yeah.
But with anything that wide, you get some pretty extreme perspective distortion in the images, which for this particular icon is not a bad thing.
No, because like you were saying, it's got a design that tapers toward the top anyway, up to a bunch of spires. So
think of it as a giant A-frame building.
Yeah. And so the things that you find with a lot of other buildings, you know, if you're doing architectural photography where you get that perspective problem, you know, with the building appearing to fall over, just doesn't exist with this one. It's going to look kind of similar no matter what. But yeah, like you were saying, we got pretty darn close. And by the way, the 14 to 24 is a really, really nice lens, you know, extremely sharp, low amount of chromatic aberration, just, you know,
very little light fall
things
off in the corners.
Right.
Even
and,
wide open.
You know, some people have complained about the lack of filters and stuff. And I understand that, you know, for certain kinds of photography, I definitely want those. And that's why for a lot of landscape stuff, I would continue to use the 17 to 35, which is another excellent lens. But for this kind of shooting and a lot of others, the 14 to 24 is great. You know, the lack of filters, just not a problem.
And you had a good take on this lens yesterday when we were driving around, and that was, you think of it more less of a wide angle zoom,
mm-hmm,
and more of a 14 millimeter lens that you can change the focal length on.
Yeah.
To just vary the perspective.
Yeah. Cause you know, it
14 is incredibly wide,
right?
14 is getting your toes in the picture if you're not careful.
Yeah. If you're using a D3.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you're using it on a DX body, it's not as wide, but still it's a significantly wide,
mm-hmm,
wide view.
Mm-hmm.
And a great lens. It's big, heavy chunk of glass.
Yeah. Huge front.
Very, yeah, bulbous front element.
Yeah.
But it works well.
Yeah. So at any rate, on our shoot, we were, you know, because the space was a little bit constricted and we were out there early enough that we couldn't get inside, you know, we've definitely got to go back there and make a return trip, you know, at a time where we can get inside, because it's got a really interesting interior too, the way it was designed. But so we were going around to different areas around the chapel, and we'll throw some photos that we took, you know, on the blog page,
right,
so you can
show
take
notes.
A look at what we were doing. But it was a combination of things where we had, you know, the entire chapel in view, as well as some of the surrounding areas, coupled with a lot of shots where we were just going more for patterns and graphic designs, and we were, you know, just doing certain portions of the chapel. And that's one of the fun things about architectural photography. There are a lot of things you can do with it. You don't want to just take the shot of the building and as a whole. You know, interesting architecture allows you to get into smaller areas, do crops, and really look for the patterns and things like that. And at least that's what I think is a lot of fun about it.
Interesting geometric designs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and yesterday I saw some of your shots, and you had the just cropped in close on the spires,
mm-hmm,
and that works really well. And if you've got a, you know, maybe if you're using a polarizer, you can get some really great contrast. We had a wonderful blue sky.
Yeah, we didn't. You didn't want to use a polarizer.
No, in fact, I was looking at some of my shots, even with the very wide ones, and the sky was so, it looks polarized,
right,
even though it's not.
Yeah, and we've talked about the challenge that we have here with the higher altitude. If you in those kind of circumstances, throw on a polarizer, it turns the sky kind of purplish black.
And that's not a good thing either.
It's pretty ugly. So we didn't need it. So that's what we did. And, you know, with our post-processing, we had some fun there too. We, both of us ended up doing a combination of black and white and color.
Right.
You know, the,
it just lent itself to that.
Oh, it absolutely did. Because with black and white, which, you know, we've talked about before, and I think is just so incredibly cool. You, really can focus on the patterns and the geometric shapes and things like that.
And one thing I was having a real fun time with, was I was using Capture NX to do my black and white conversion. Mm-hmm. And that's not bad, although the black and white conversion tool in NX isn't really fancy. Mm-hmm. It has some decent options, but it doesn't have tone curve kinds of stuff, mm-hmm. although you can do that. But I was using the color control points, mm-hmm. and putting them in the sky and using those, just the brightness and the contrast control is all you really need to mess with. Mm-hmm. And then you can emphasize different parts. So different panels on the building, I could make really light and give them contrast to offset
right.
the geometric patterns. I could make the sky darker and make the clouds have more contrast. So I took some images that would have been where the skies were otherwise kind of flat, mm-hmm. and really punched them up, mm-hmm. in the black and white, and it's great.
Yeah. And the way I was working with mine was a little bit different. I was doing the initial tweaks in Lightroom and then throwing it over to Photoshop CS3, and then I was using the, you know, throwing on an adjustment layer, you know, with the black and white filters it has, and, you know, it's kind of staying in the red filter realm. Mm-hmm. That worked pretty well for getting dramatic sky.
If you put a red filter on the black and white, you're going to make that sky really dark.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
Yeah.
And I got another shot when we were leaving. We switched to a little longer focal length because we were walking away, and we were mm-hmm. now facing east, so the rising sun was mm-hmm. behind us. The sky is a little washed out, but mm-hmm. caught the building sort of in silhouette, but the stained glass was lighting up on one edge of
right.
the building. And I got, did you get any shots of that?
I did. I haven't done any post-processing on those, and I saw your print. And
it's neat.
It is very
cool. It's just
cool.
different. And that's mm-hmm. another thing that you mentioned at the top of this segment, that if you're going to do any kind of, I won't say stock photography, but if you're looking to shoot stuff that might sell, one thing that you need to do is try to, I mean, let's face it, here in Colorado Springs, there's only a couple of icons. Mm-hmm. If it's an icon, everyone knows, everyone's seen the same picture. You've got to try to do something different.
Right.
So getting a shot of the chapel that doesn't have the background behind it, where it isn't that same look that everybody else has, instead is a little more darker silhouette with the stained glass illuminated. Mm-hmm. It's just a different take on the same thing, and it might have more interest to other people who say, wow, that's a really,
right.
really, I mean, you got to do the classic shot too.
Right.
Because there are some people who that's what they want. They have it in their mind and they want that image, that kind of postcard image.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of trying to, and this was something I read in a Bob Crist article in the recent issue of Outdoor Photographer, mm-hmm. which is, if you're trying to do any kind of stock on location, gone are the days where you could be a mile wide and an inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be an inch thick and a mile deep.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to really focus on a small area, instead of having a wide range of locations. Focus on a smaller range of locations, but do the different stuff, do them extensively, get mm-hmm. things that not everyone else has,
mm-hmm.
so that your images will stand out and say, well, that's something unique about this that I didn't even think
right.
of.
Right. Now, and using this as an example, you know, some of the shots that I took that I really like, you know, on a personal level, wouldn't work well for that stock photography
right.
or, you know, selling prints, at least not as well as others. And the reason is that you really kind of have to know what it is in order to recognize, you know, that the shot was made at the chapel. It could be a whole bunch of different things around the world. And so that doesn't work as well. Whereas with the shot that you were talking about with the stained glass, it's easy to recognize that it's the chapel there.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people want. So you have to know, you know, who you're selling your stuff to and what their interests are. But, you know, do the personal stuff too.
Now, no segment that we do on this show would be complete if we didn't have some sort of accessory to make your life easier.
Mm-hmm.
And you recently purchased an e-screen
mm-hmm.
for your D3.
Right.
And e-screens have been available for a lot of different cameras for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I know they're available for the D2X. I know they're available for, well, any of the cameras that have interchangeable viewfinders, basically, or interchangeable screens.
Right.
Viewfinders is old school stuff.
Yeah.
You have to have like F5 kind of camera to do that. But the E-Screen has the grid lines on it, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is not an expensive accessory.
No.
They're
like 30-something bucks.
Not a bad deal.
But it does help. It wasn't a big deal for shooting at the chapel, but in situations where it's really important that you get your horizon level and you're watching what's really happening with the verticals and how much tilt you've got going on, it can help. Now, the interesting thing is that the cheaper Nikon bodies often have an on-demand grid that you can just turn on.
Which is very neat.
Yeah. And so cameras like the, you know, I know for sure the D200 and D300 have it. I think maybe the D80 has it.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. There are a bunch that have it. And so if you haven't played with that feature, give it a try. In the D300, I just leave it on all the time because I like grid screens.
It's very,
I don't find
very
them
helpful.
Distracting or anything.
No, and if that's the kind of stuff that you do, it'll really help you get your horizon straight.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're on a tripod, sometimes, especially if you're using a ball head, it's easy to get it a little bit off, even if the tripod is level.
Right.
So,
you know, broadening out the topic of architectural photography, you know, one thing that's frustrating for a lot of people is they feel like they live somewhere where there aren't a lot of interesting things to go shoot. You know, we're fortunate in that we're, you know, not too far away from, you know, some really great landscape locations, wildlife, things like that. And that isn't the case everywhere. But you can almost always find something that can work well in the architectural realm. And that doesn't mean it has to be some sort of famous building. It could be something old and decrepit and run down and falling apart, and it could be fun to go shoot. So, you know, look for those things in the area where you live. You know, obviously, if you live over in Europe or something like that, you're really blessed with some really great right. things. But it doesn't have to be beautiful and pristine. It can be the exact opposite, and you can do some really interesting things.
And one thing that's really nice about architectural photography is you can encompass just about every scale that you want.
Mm-hmm.
You can use wide angles and get entire buildings. Mm-hmm. You can use telephotos mm-hmm. and zoom in on tight spots. Heck, you could probably even use a macro lens in certain places
sure.
if you wanted to,
yeah.
Depending on what the situation was and what the subject was. So you could go with three lenses in your camera bag, you know, something like a mid-range zoom, a wide-angle lens, and maybe a short telephoto. And you could play around and,
yeah, and
just
I'll
on
take
one
it,
subject, you could go and get
right.
a variety of shots.
Yeah. But I'll throw a different spin on it. You could have just one lens.
Right.
And it could be a fixed focal length lens, and you could have a blast doing architectural photography. You could have a 50 millimeter lens and do some really, really cool stuff. So this is kind of a follow on to our cheap episode. Architectural photography can be a really cheap thing to do because you don't necessarily need the super fancy things.
Well, and the subjects don't move. They don't run away.
No.
They're usually accessible. You can get them in a variety of lighting conditions. You can go back in the evening mm-hmm. and shoot these things at night. So there's a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Some of the most interesting shots I've seen are time exposures at night.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're shooting digital with the ability now to really crank up ISOs,
mm-hmm.
shoot at higher ISOs, you can get some very interesting shots just after dark, or it's not really dark yet, but it
right.
would be for Velvia 50.
Right.
You'd have
right.
no chance. It would be a 30-second exposure, and you can do some very interesting things
mm-hmm.
and get those buildings where you still have some blue sky or that midnight blue sky, and then especially on buildings that are lit up at night,
mm-hmm.
really fun.
Yeah. Give yourself a self-assignment.
There you go.
Yeah. Next few weeks, get out there and try.
If anyone asks you, tell them it's
because
the image doctors have given you a task
yeah.
to go out and do that.
Yeah. All right.
Now, we wanted to quickly talk about your quick and dirty comparison between my 24-70 and your 28-70.
Right.
You did a very, was it non-scientific?
Well,
but at least
I certainly used tripods. I certainly controlled the composition, the focus, you know, all of those kind of things.
Were you shooting brick walls?
Not quite.
Okay. So this is not the, this is a, our assessment. It's sort of qualitative.
It's a practical one.
But it's, yeah, it's not the, okay, we're going to shoot a brick wall and look for percentages of barrel distortion in these two kinds of lenses.
But it's the kind of thing I've done many times before, and you get very predictable results, and you know, I feel comfortable with the results. So at any rate, we've been getting pestered for a long time to do this comparison, including from, you know, the times before the 2040-70 was even on the market. You know, as soon as it was announced, we actually got an email, I think. So it's been in the queue for a while. I've owned a 2870-28 for quite a few years. And you know, when the 2470 came out, I thought, well, you know,
there's always that temptation.
Yeah,
maybe it's better.
Yeah. And I ended up resisting it and taking the more rational view of, you know, since I already have the 2870, I'll just wait, see how it works in the D3, see if I'm happy, and then base my decision on that. And, you know, at that point, we didn't know how the D3 was going to work, you know, with lenses that have been around a while. It's, you know, surprisingly good is what we found. But we just really had no idea. So when I got it, I started shooting things with the 28-70 and was very, very pleased. You know, the results I was getting were very sharp, contrasty, lots of fine detail, just nothing bad, you know, no chromatic aberration problems. So I was pleased. And so then I decided to put off doing the test because I didn't really want to see if the differences at that point and be tempted.
If you're happy with what you have, it's sometimes better not to see what the other stuff is.
But we continued to get notes and stuff like that.
And since I had purchased the lens.
Yeah, right.
Now, because I was in a different situation. I was coming from never having shot, never having had the pro lens collection that you did in my film days.
Right.
So when I was upgrading lenses, I leaned towards DX. And for me, the 1755 was a lot better choice for my D2X than a 2870 was. Mm-hmm. And we had already done that comparison once upon a time, mm-hmm. and found that, you know, those lenses were pretty comparable. So when it came time to get a D3, I realized I needed a new mid-range zoom, because I really didn't want to use the 1755 in crop mode on a D3. It just doesn't make sense.
Yep.
So I figured, what the heck, I'll buy this new 24-70, and so I did.
Right.
Now you took them both home over a weekend and you
made a bunch of shots and, you know, basically did test shots at the 28 millimeter focal length, 50, and then 70. You know, so I just did those three focal lengths.
And a variety of apertures.
Yeah, everything from wide open to 5.6 to f/11. That's basically what I did. And so
that's the range you're mostly using anyway.
Yeah, so I did a bunch of, you know, test shots.
And so what were you looking for? Sharpness, chromatic aberration, light fall off in the corners, those kinds of things that you would notice on a shot.
Right.
Not extreme distortion necessarily. Because again, all those measurements of distortion, while they're there, a lot of times you'll just never even notice them in an image.
Right.
Unless you're really into architecture photography.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get one of those perspective controlled lenses we talked about last time.
Right.
So what'd you find?
Well, I think it's safe to say that in the end, both of us were happy with our decisions. And so that was a good outcome. I was kind of relieved. What I found is that the 28-70 and the 24-70 produce results that are virtually identical for the most part. Both are very sharp lenses and the images even look pretty similar. You know, when you start looking at out of focus areas at maximum aperture, they have the same look, you know, so they're definitely cousins, amazingly similar results. The only thing I found, was that with the 24-70, if you were shooting at 28 millimeters or close to it, and you were shooting wide open, that lens had the advantage toward the edges of the frame. And the center part of the image looked identical, absolutely identical. But as you got out toward the edges, the extreme parts of the corners, I could definitely see a difference with the 2470. It was sharper in those quarters. Mm-hmm. The 28-70, you know, had a distinct loss of sharpness out there.
This is probably gone by what, F4?
Yeah, it disappeared quickly. And so that was not a problem. I didn't see any difference in fine detail. I didn't see any difference in chromatic aberration. So the conclusion I reached for me, I'm going to keep the 28-70. There's no reason for me to buy a 2470. And my thought process is I honestly don't care about those corners at maximum aperture. It's never a problem compositionally or in terms of photos, because if I'm shooting at maximum aperture, I'm typically isolating a subject. And
so you're not even interested in the corners because you're expecting them to be out of focus anyway.
Exactly. So it's just not a real world problem for me. Now, there, you know, someone else could have a different set of needs and stuff, but that's just not something I really care much about. So it works fine. I like the handling fine. The 24-70 is certainly a much trimmer lens, but my hands are pretty decent sized, and I find both lenses are very comfortable to use.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and then so it really comes down to practical differences.
Mm-hmm.
Like we talked about last week, if you're on a budget, I'm sure there are people out there who are getting rid of their 28-70s just because they have to have mm-hmm. the latest and greatest thing on their D3s or whatever. And so you might be able to pick one up used. I will warn everyone, of course, that that lens, the 28-70 lens, is one of the, you know, it's a pro Nikkor lens.
Mm-hmm.
And it resale, while you'll get it cheaper than new, it's still going to have a pretty hefty price tag on it. Yeah. But that's something nice when you buy the good lenses.
Yeah.
They have good resale value.
Now, if I were going to go out and buy a brand new lens and budget wasn't an issue, which one would I buy? Well, definitely the 24-70. And the reason is to get the 24 millimeter focal length, which is handy, you know. And just when we were shooting at the chapel the other day, I had my 28-70 on, you know, for a lot of shots. And there were a few times I would have liked to come out just a touch further. 24 would have been perfect. 28 was slightly tight, but I could make it work.
And now when we were working, I mean, this made a difference to us because we were limited in how far we could back up.
Right.
And so there were sometimes constraints where the zoom does help you, a wider focal length.
I could have just switched lenses and stuff, but sometimes it is nice to have that slightly expanded range. Is it enough to make me go out there and sell my current one and buy a 24-70? Nah.
Other differences, the 28-70 has a manual aperture ring,
mm-hmm.
whereas the 24-70 is a G design. So if you've got an older body that you wanted to,
like an F4, retain
compatibility with, yeah, you're going to want to think about the 28-70.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, 24 is the new sort of wide angle mm-hmm. focal length. It used to be 28, and now it seems like 24 is that new magic number.
Mm-hmm.
So having more range is never a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
The coating on the 24-70 may be a little bit, it's got the nano crystal coat, so that should help with flare. I don't shoot my lens directly into the sun most of the time, so it's not, and if you're using the lens hood that's right, it's quite large in either of these lenses, you're not going to get a lot of extraneous light coming in.
And I didn't get a chance to test for flare just because of the way the lighting conditions were over that weekend. But like you said, it's not something I regularly do. And I haven't had big issues with the 28-70 on that front, honestly. So, you know, I didn't worry a whole heck of a lot about it.
Right. When people talk about differences between these lenses, or handles this better, handles that better, you have to always ask yourself, is that how I'm using this lens?
Right.
Because if it's not, it's never an issue.
Right.
They're both 2.8. If you're shooting at f5.6 or f8 all the time, the corner sharpness issue goes away.
Yeah.
So there's just things like that. You always have to put it in perspective of what your needs are as a photographer before you say, I got to have this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm happy with what I bought.
Yeah. And I'm happy with mine. So
that's good.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not the super detail, but I think that's the practical review.
Right.
These
lenses, that's our intent.
The bottom line is that both of these lenses are very good. They're very close to each other in terms of performance. So if it comes down to buying, you should let your needs and your budget guide the way.
Right. Okay. Autofocus fine tuning.
Oh boy.
This is an interesting one.
Yeah.
This is a brand new feature on the D3 and D300. And what it allows you to do is calibrate your autofocus for a specific lens. And
when I first heard this, it was announced in some other manufacturer's camera, and I first thought of it, and I said, well, and even when it was first announced in the D3, I said, well, that's nice, but it sounds, it still sounds kind of gimmicky.
Or I guess the way it sounded to me was that it was more of a psychological thing. There wasn't really much of an issue, honestly, but this is a good way to kind of pacify people.
Right. It's like, but it's there should you need to be anal retentive about it. It's there.
Right.
Then we used it.
Yeah. And I've changed my mind. I got to tell you, I've really changed my mind on this one. And my feeling is that it probably ought to exist on every Nikon DSLR and the other brands as well.
It's a great feature.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about it.
This is not to say that our lenses were ever bad before.
No, but it's been interesting. The way both of us ended up using this thing, it turned out to be pretty similar, and that is we'll take a lens, and the bigger areas of concern are going to be longer focal lengths, faster apertures, you know, any kind of situation where, you know, at the maximum aperture, there's little depth of field.
Right. So really, if you're, this is very helpful for the 300-500 millimeter territory, or
but
longer.
But even something like an 85-1.4 or a 50-1.4 with a shallow depth of field at maximum aperture, it's potentially helpful. And what we both did was picked out, you know, what we thought were decent test targets. And you don't have to have something fancy. Just something where, you know, the autofocus is going to be able to lock on. And
but your methodology and how you set this up is critical to getting this to work. And this is where we say, be careful. You'll drive yourself insane if you don't devise a standardized method for doing the calibration. You need to use a tripod.
You need to use a tripod. You need to keep careful note of your settings one way or another. And there are a bunch of ways of doing that. For a test target, I used several different things, and incidentally, all of them produced the same exact result. So I know it was working for that reason as well as one other. But I picked the stock page out of a newspaper. It's got lots and lots of fine print on it. And what I did is I taped it up on the window of my Jeep, and I did it outside in good lighting. The reason I did it outside is I was testing a bunch of lenses, different focal lengths, and I needed to be fairly close. And in some cases, I needed to be fairly far away. You know, like with a 600 millimeter, you can't be too close.
Yeah, and what's very important here is that whatever your target is, it needs to be flat. You don't want to have something angled towards you. You want to make sure that you're more or less perpendicular to the target, and that target is going to flat, because you're looking for slight differences in front or back focusing, and you could be thrown off. So you have to be very careful when you're doing your analysis.
Right.
I found that cereal boxes were great for this, and there's two reasons. One is that they're stiff cardboard, so it's already flat. I can stick it somewhere and shoot at it.
Right.
And the other reason why I like it is because they're printed with usually pretty small halftone pattern. And you can really tell when that halftone pattern is sharp, the dots in the printing.
Right.
And, or a color brochure is something that works kind of, kind of nice too. And so
it certainly
makes
if you have
no question. If when I was looking at my images, when I had it nailed, I was like, okay.
And certainly an honest to God lens test target would be a nice thing. I just don't have one, and I didn't find it. It was really necessary.
But you don't want to set up your camera at an angle to the to the target. You want to make sure it's flat, because otherwise you're going to have a harder time assessing the images and choosing the right one. You don't want to miss. If you're going to mess with the calibration of your focus, you don't want to do it wrong.
Right. Now, the way the settings work in both of those two cameras is they'll range from minus 20 to plus 20. And what I did, and I think you did, is I first started off with a run of going from minus 20 to plus 20 in increments of 5.
Yeah, that's what I did.
And so what I would do is I'd start off, set it to minus 20, throw the lens out of focus. This works easiest if you're using an AFS lens, because you can just grab the focusing ring and do it, but you can do it with other ones. You just have to disengage the focus in some cases. So completely throw it out of focus, lock on, you know, using the AFS system, take a picture, then bump the increment up by 5. So now I'm at minus 15, throw it completely out of focus, reacquire focus again, take another shot, and then repeat. Go all the way from minus 20 to plus 20.
And it's very important that you throw the lens out of focus between each shot so that the autofocus system can truly reacquire the target. Otherwise, it might just think it's still locked on.
If it's close enough, it won't change focus, which is a problem.
And you'll get all your shots look the same. You won't know what you did.
Right. So what I found typically was that I got a nice, smooth progression in sharpness. And what I would do is, you know, when I was done with all the images, just, you know, download them on my PC. And then I would bring up each one of them in Photoshop in different windows. There's some things that you can do to match the zoom level and the location level. Right. And I was looking at them at 100%. And so I'd typically have, you know, a whole bunch of shots up on the screen, each zoomed into a little quadrant. And again, I could see a nice smooth progression from out of focus to the point of maximum sharpness, and then out of focus again on the other end. So that told me that my process was working. I didn't have a bad test target, a lack of light or whatever, because it was a consistent thing. Now, when I tried some lenses with 2x converters on them, you know, which is pushing the autofocus system past the spec limit in a lot of cases, I saw some variability going on. So that said, I probably am not going to mess with it in this situation just because the autofocus system is at the limits. But when you see the nice smooth progression, you don't worry about it. And so I would look through those shots and I could figure out where the point of maximum sharpness was. Now, for a really fast lens or a really long one or both that has really limited depth of field, those increments of 5 weren't quite precise enough. And then I do a first run.
Do you take the best one?
Mm-hmm. I get the range that it was within, and then I do a second run going in increments of 2, because that really did make a difference sometimes.
Right, so let's say you pick the best image was minus 10, then you'd go back again and you'd do from minus 15 to minus 5 in increments of 2, and then look at those images and you might be able to see
and
that
pick out the
even better one. And if it's really tight, you could do increments of 1, but that gets tedious.
I didn't get that. I didn't do that.
But the critical thing here is you need to be on a stable platform. If you're doing this indoors, I recommend using a flash. Mm-hmm. If you're using something like a D300, one thing that you could try to do would be to put the pop-up flash into commander mode and use your flash off camera. Because a lot of times what happens is when you're really well aligned with one of these paper targets, the flash reflects right back into the lens and it just washes everything out.
Right.
You can't really see what's... So if you're going to use a flash, you need to be careful. So putting a remote flash at an angle to the target works well, I found. But that's, you know, getting fancy.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is getting the right amount of distance to your subject. You want to be close enough so that you can really tell when things are sharp. You want to be in that range. Like when I was looking at those halftone patterns, if I'm too far away, they're never going to appear because it just doesn't resolve it. And if I'm too close, I'm always going to resolve them and I'm not going to see any differences. So there was a magic distance where I'd really start to see where I could nail those patterns being sharp.
Now some things that I did just to make sure that I understood what was happening here and it wasn't some situation where it was only being optimized for one shooting distance. I ended up shooting just some completely different targets. In this case, they were cars or houses that were, you know, 10 times, 20 times the distance that I was shooting the newspaper at. And tried the same process. And I incidentally, I got identical results. So
if you're doing it right, it'll
work. Yeah. So there wasn't a distance effect or anything like that. Some other interesting thing. Well, first of all, it did make a big difference. At maximum aperture with these lenses, there in some cases was an appreciable difference in sharpness.
Yeah, where I really saw it was when I started calibrating my 200 to 400 VR.
Mm-hmm.
When I just used the lens, it was pretty much on the money. I left it at zero. I didn't need any calibration.
Mm-hmm.
I put the TC17 on it. All of a sudden, I needed a calibration, and I was able to dramatically improve the accuracy of the focus with that with that lens, with the teleconverter. And the camera, what's really kind of neat is that when you have these combinations, it stores each one and it tells you what lens it is. So it'll automatically remember the lens.
Mm-hmm.
So if I put my 200 to 400, I don't have to go in there. As long as fine tune is enabled,
mm-hmm.
it'll automatically go, oh, that's your 200, 400.
Yeah,
you're setting a zero
correction.
Or whatever.
Right. The thing that got me going on this was, you know, I'd mentioned several podcasts ago, or you had, I think, that I'd gotten a 600 F4. And, you know, one of the things I'd heard about it was that the sharpness wide open was pretty much the same as stop down, a couple stops, which is a cool thing. But that's not what I was seeing. I was seeing a real drop off in sharpness at maximum aperture, which was kind of a bummer.
Because that's how you want to use that lens.
Right. So I thought, well, you know, maybe it's a used lens. Maybe some elements got bumped sometime in the past. Maybe I need to send it in and have it fixed. And fortunately, I thought, well, I'll try this procedure first. And what I found is I had to use a setting of plus 18 on that lens. And fortunately, at plus 20, I saw a drop off in sharpness again. Plus 18 was the peak. And with that set, now I get the same results pretty much at maximum aperture as I do stop down. And then I thought, well, maybe I need to check my other lenses. What I found is that, you know, when I was shooting with the faster lenses, like we talked about, the longer ones, at least half of them benefited from a correction. And honestly, I think if I did the math, it'd be more like 70%, which was a surprise.
Now, I don't think this is from lens design or anything like that necessarily. I think, well,
first off,
I think with a long focal length lens is when the depth of field is razor thin to begin mm-hmm. with. I think that's where you're going to see the maximum benefit of this.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't take much to be off.
Right. Now, the really important thing, the way the autofocus system works, it's not a situation where, you know, it's looking at how out of focus it is and it keeps oscillating things back and forth, you know, near and far until it reaches the point of maximum sharpness. It doesn't work that way, and it's for some speed reasons. So it looks at how far off it is and some changes over focusing distance, and then it takes a guess at how far it's going to have to move and then stops. That's my understanding of it, and it's validated because of this procedure. So there are some reasons why it varies a bit. Now, an interesting result for me, and you had the same thing happen, is we both have D3s and D300s. And what I found is that I was getting, you know, for a given lens, I was getting identical results for my D3 and D300. The same calibration setting was the right one.
That's what I found
and
as well.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, which says that it's not really the camera bodies that are varying, at least in our cases. Can't say that's always the case. It was the lens.
It's a sample size of two, so your mileage may vary.
Right. But that's what we're seeing so far. But we're also seeing that we're seeing different calibration settings for lenses that are the same model number. You're getting slightly different results than I'm mm-hmm. getting. One other thing is I'll just mention that I was seeing, you know, both negative settings being required as well as positive settings. So it wasn't like the camera was just off in one direction.
Right. If you're, and I guess that's a good point, because if your camera, no matter what lens you put on it, mm-hmm. consistently focuses behind, which would be a back focus, mm-hmm. or in front of, front focusing your target, then that's a camera calibration issue. You need to send that back to Nikon for, mm-hmm. for service. But if you're talking, what we're talking about is fixing differences between slight differences in lenses that caused the camera to misfocus a little bit.
Yeah. Now, we don't want you to get all paranoid about this. Especially if you've got an older body that doesn't have the feature. It is a good feature. It's not going to be much of a factor, you know, when the lens is stopped down a little bit. It typically goes away quite quickly just because, you know, you get a little bit more depth of field. But
especially on your wider angle lenses mm-hmm. too.
Oh yeah. It just doesn't matter. You're not, if you run the test with the really wide ones, if they're not too fast, you're not going to see a tremendous variation. My 14 to 24 does benefit from it though.
My initial results
at 24,
I didn't need to put anything
right.
in, but see, that's the thing.
Lens.
That could be sample
mm-hmm.
variation.
Mm-hmm. But, if you do have the faster lenses, the longer ones, and do a lot of shooting at maximum aperture, consider doing this. It's the most boring, mind-numbing thing that you'll ever do with your camera.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you're going to want to devote an afternoon to it if you've got a bunch of lenses. But it's a benefit. And
be prepared to be completely ridiculed by your spouse.
Right.
What the hell are you doing out there?
Yeah.
Shooting a newspaper.
But here's one thing it definitely told me, because now that you can easily vary this parameter around, lenses do vary. So when you hear people complaining about a back focus or front focus problem, don't ridicule them. They very well may have an issue. So, you know, this feature proves it, you know, once you know, do things and get results with it. Okay.
All right. Well, that brings us to the last thing we need to talk about today, which would be our photo prescription.
Mm-hmm.
And our prescription for this week sort of came out of our little trip to the academy over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
That's scouting your location beforehand.
Right.
If you're going to get a shot of something, especially like we tend to do, which is that early morning light,
mm-hmm.
where you're after it, it's pretty important to know where you're going and how long it's going to take you to get there and where you want to be and give yourself the time to set up. And believe me, at 4 a.m, it's too dark to really be making these decisions, and you're probably not thinking about it right. So it's always a good thing, if you have the time, if possible, to go to your location first,
mm-hmm.
see where you want to shoot, and then say, okay, tomorrow or whenever, when we go back, I know I need to be here, and it's this far from the parking lot. You learn a lot of things.
Right. You'll want to look at where the sun is likely to come up, and what is that going to do, you know, for lighting, just so you can plan ahead and be at the right spot. You know, and think a little bit about how your primary subject's going to relate to things in the background.
Well, what focal lengths to bring.
Yeah.
You know, if you know you're in tight spaces and you know you need to go wide,
mm-hmm.
then that's fine. On the other hand, if you're really far away, if you can't get close to your subject, you think, well, I don't need to bring that 20mm lens today, and mm-hmm. I'll just be shooting it with my 70.
Yeah. And, you know, the location that we went to wasn't a big deal, because that's not far away from us, and you know, we can go there whenever we want, practically. But especially if you're in a situation where it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, you know, where you'll only be there once in the kind of light that you want, go there the day before in bad light and just scout it out. Makes a huge difference.
And then all those other things will happen, too. You can start pre-visualizing the shots that you want. Oh, that would be good.
Yeah.
Maybe I want to bring that 200 because I'm going to get something really neat with that spot.
Again, for a once-in-a-lifetime shoot, you don't want to be coming to those conclusions 3 days later, you know, when you're looking at your images on a computer.
So avoid the woulda, coulda, shoulda,
mm-hmm.
as they say, and go out in advance and scout your location. And I can tell you, after yesterday, even yesterday, we didn't know where we'd have to park.
Right.
We weren't sure which roads were open or closed. And so by the time we got there, we had missed the best light.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go back. Now we know this. We know it's going to be a 10 or 15 minute walk from the parking, or 10 minute walk from the parking lot to get set up. And so we know we may need to make sure that we're there a little earlier next mm-hmm. time.
Yep.
Okay, well, I think that brings us to the end of this episode, and we'll of course be back in 2 weeks.
Yep. And as always, we'll put in the reminder, if you haven't voted for us or thrown in a comment on Podcast Alley, we show up under Nikonians Talk Radio, and we do appreciate it.
Vote early, vote often.
Yep.
As they say. And
in Chicago, I think.
I think that's what happens the most. That's right. So send us your emails to talkradio@nikonians.org. Check us out. You can see our whole archives on the blog, blog.nikonians.org.
Oh, and one other reminder, again, we are doing those digital workshops, you know, on printing and post-processing in San Francisco and in Dallas. So if you go to the Nikonians homepage, look up toward the top middle, and you'll see a thing on workshops. And you can find it under there. But we'll put a link in it to it also.
Yep.
So those should be a lot of fun.
Okay, we'll see you guys next time.
All right, bye-bye.